The Strand was going to turn into dual carriageway. Covent Garden would go. Whitehall was going to get was go other than the Banqueting House and 10 Downing Street. The urban destruction that would have involved, had it, I mean, it's mad, would have made the Blitz feel like a mere rounding error in comparison.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Country Life podcast with me, your host, James Fisher. I've got an extremely exciting guest today, someone I admire deeply. It's Nicholas Boys-Smith, MBE. He's the founder of Create Streets. He's the chair of the Office for Place, and he's a man with ideas on how to solve the housing crisis. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you very much. That's a very friendly introduction. I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Oh, it's well deserved, if you ask me. Well deserved. So we'll start off with Create Streets. Can you tell us a bit about Create Streets?
Yes. So Create Streets is a design consultancy, town builder and social enterprise, sort of specialist think tank. I set it up just over 10 years ago out of frustration, I think it's fair to say. I mean, I had a previous career as a strategy consultant and working for an international bank, live in South London. I began to get increasingly frustrated, and I could probably use ruder words, about the nature and the quality of what I saw happening to London in terms of new buildings and the way we were managing our public places. I'd always had a sort of latent interest in architecture and design as I went off doing other things. And so I just started increasingly reading about it. And the more I read about it, the more I thought, oh, hang on, where we live, the nature of our streets and squares has a quite predictable consequence for the quality of our lives as humans and indeed as neighbourhoods. And the evidence of that isn't, I came to the view, sufficiently informing public policy or bluntly even investment decisions by developers. And the more I spoke to architects or urban designers or planners, the more I thought, with all due respect to all the people I spoke to, they just haven't read this stuff. They're not on top of it. And the few I met who I felt had partly read it, or to any rate were vaguely convincing, I didn't think were speaking in a way that was likely to influence senior officials or politicians or even, you know, pension funds or developers. And actually, it all came to a head. I saw part of an estate in South London that was being knocked down. I drove past on the way to my pot plants at B&Q with my then, I think, very young son. What was being proposed to replace it was, I mean, it was probably slightly better than what had been built in the 60s and 70s, but, you know, barely. Anyway, so to cut a long story short, so I'm giving you a long and rambling answer to your simple question. Forgive me, James. At our heart, we do research into where people are happy in the built environment, why, what they like, where they're more likely to speak to their neighbours, where people will pay more to live. That's, you know, that's a necessary thing. Guess what? There's a correlation between where people will pay more and places people prefer. How we can improve and grow public support for new development, partly to pay for it, partly to bring it to life. We then work for actually now quite a growing range of councils, landowners, developers, above all community groups, actually, to bring that to life, whether that be in local design codes or master plans or in local policy if we're working for a council. And we've ended up, I think it's fair to say, having quite a prominent part in the conversation about national planning policy and the national housing crisis. So that was a long answer, but I hope that sort of comes in. I can dive into more detail on any of those. Some might say an interminable length, but there's more available if you want it.
No, that's great. That was great. So what are some of the issues you've identified with the sort of state of development in the country at the moment, especially in a sort of urban context? You know, whether it's, are there enough trees? Are there enough parks? Are there enough, you know, do we live close enough to the doctor? Is it stuff like that? Or is it slightly more complex?
So many ways to take that question. let me take it at a more fundamental level, which is this. In a YouGov poll done a few years ago, 2% of the public, trusted developers to make existing places better with new development. And 7% of the public, trusted councils and planners to make places better.
No.
Those aren't great stats. I mean, that's low levels of public trust. I mean, let's be frank, that is, you know, staggeringly low levels of public trust in our ability, I wouldn't even say as an industry, as a culture, as a society, to improve the places we live in through putting money in them. You might say, it's a phrase I've used a bit over the years, we've sort of fallen out of love with the future. And it's notable, you know, and it's not a criticism of the heritage industry. You know, the heritage industry has grown and grown, the heritage industry, over the last 30 or 40 years. That's, you know, not a bad thing, but in a way, it's ridiculous that we want to preserve so much of what was in the past because we just don't think that what replaces it will be better. I mean, sort of, again, that's not an attack on the heritage industry at all. But it's quite an odd state of affairs we've got to. So I think at its heart, it's that. Now, there are lots of ways you can unpick what that means in practice. One thing is we don't trust, again, you can see this in the polling, we don't trust people to, you know, from over there to come in and do things. We've lost trust in the man in Whitehall. It used to be a man, the White in County Hall. We lost that trust. We've lost trust that new buildings will look nicer than old buildings. That's very, very clear in the polling. We've lost trust that new places will be for sort of quote unquote people like us. That manifests itself differently in different places. So go to a social housing estate in London being redeveloped or, you know, regenerated, to use the lingo. Most of the people living there, say at the start of the process, will instinctively assume that they'll be forced to move out by the process. Well, that's not great politics for a start. Go to, you know, go to a village and talk about, you know, some drive-through cul-de-sacs on the edge of the village or maybe sprawling out of the countryside around it, and there'll be an instinctive belief that those houses won't be for you know, the sons or daughters or cousins of people who already live in the village. That may not be an entirely fair concern, but it's certainly there. We've lost trust that the associated downside of new development won't be greater than the associated upside. So actually, you know, creating more homes can create far more clients for shops. But people will be more worried about the traffic or the pressure on school places or doctor surgery places than they will be on potentially, you know, investment in the local economy. And one of the reasons for that, so I'm giving up a long answer, is that increasingly the development we create is, if you like, is centrifugal, not centripetal. It spins out, and maybe it will create a new shop on a box on the ring road, but it doesn't create the patterns of movement that make people want to come to the local high street or to sit and work and spend time in the local village centre or town centre. So what it looks like, how it works, where it is, we have lost confidence. And Craig Street's mission is to help the public fall back in love with the future by changing the way we do planning, by ultimately changing and improving the education of architects and planners, and by empowering parish councils, town councils, local people, actually to set a clear quality ask for what new places
again, a very good answer. Now, we like rambling on that, like, that's what podcasting is all about. Looking at the UK as a whole, we've got a sort of rich tradition of our heritage buildings. They're things we love. You know, we've architecture is obviously a great focus of this magazine. That's always going to conflict is maybe not the right word, but let's use it anyway. Conflict with new developments and new regeneration, because people, like you say, just see things being knocked down and replaced by giant glass boxes, as is so often the case in, say, London today. Is there a way for, in your opinion, for new buildings, new development, new regenerations to tap into that love of our heritage, to create these kind of spaces that people want to live, that people accept, like you say, building for the future?
There is no... Yes, short answer, yes. Let me give you a short answer for once. Slightly longer answer. there is no iron law of economics or of physics or of anything else that prevents us creating new places that are every bit as lovely, in fact, lovelier than what we've built in the past. We are, you know, Britain is a relatively less powerful country than it was 100 years ago. But in terms of absolute prosperity and wealth, we're infinitely richer than we've ever been at any point in our past. We have at our, you know, at our fingertips, powers of technology and of emulation we've never enjoyed before. It's true that craftsmen are, in relative terms, much more expensive than they were 100 or 200 years ago. But we can do things with technology we couldn't do 100 or 200 years ago. There's nothing stopping us creating buildings of loveliness other than mind-forged manacles, to slightly misuse Blake. So what do people, if you ask people, what is it they love about their local place? And what should new development look like and be like? If you go out and ask, what you tend to find, and I'm going to generalise wildly here, but not I think unfairly, outside big cities, people are incredibly aware of local building materials. Perhaps more, Cotswold is an obvious example, but actually, and we've done this, if you go and run visual preference surveys or ask people this question in Surrey or Sussex or Yorkshire, you get very clearly demarcated answer with people in Surrey and Sussex saying, we'll have red brick, please. And people in Yorkshire say, guess what? We want Yorkstone. We've actually not done that survey in Cotswolds, but I know what the answer would be.
Yes, me too.
Now you get, as I say, in big cities, that is less true, to be fair. So people are very aware of that. And they're also very aware of what you might call the rhythm of new buildings. So we're always very careful on this. We don't say that new, I mean, it's not for us to say what any new building should look like, which is a social enterprise, but it's up to local people. But it's not quite that people say new buildings must look like the old buildings, but they do want them to rhyme. So they do, on the whole, want them to similar, all the same materials, and they want them to have the same coherence and variety in a pattern and human scale and texture. That one easy way of doing that is to copy what's there before, but it isn't the only way. Due to the width of the roads, provision for parking, it's a hard challenge to come by, the quality of the build materials, lack of local materials, nine times out of 10, probably a bit more of that, you know, a new housing estate or a new development doesn't achieve that. There are many exceptions, I'm pleased to say. If you could give people confidence that what they set in what we call a local visual design code, that'll be an easy route to planning for most developers. I don't think you quite ban other stuff. You create a really clear, fast track, a de-risked approach to planning for landowners or developers that fits what local people set as what they want stuff to be like. It arrived at visually and empirically. Then you incentivize the vast majority of developers and landowners to do something that is locally popular. And you can discover what's locally popular pretty easily, we think, from all our work, whether that's online polling, offline polling, running workshops, running longer engagement processes. So you help, if you like, local communities discover their local vernacular and how they want it to evolve and change. And then you roll the dice, perhaps you weight the dice, I should say, in favor of that type of development. Not quite banning other stuff. I think that would be going together. And just one other thought. I mean, this is pointless, I think, is not sufficiently realized by most planners, let alone by most members of the public, is the degree to which the English planning system is very differentiated, very different from most other planning systems, which tend to actually to regulate what you can build a little bit more clearly than ours does. Ours, if you like, is good at coping with the weird and the wonderful, and bad at defining clearly the good local, the good ordinary, I should say.
I understand. I know Create Streets has been, to sort of use a case study, Create Streets has been involved with the redevelopment of Orchard House, which other people will know as the Marks and Spencers on Oxford Street.
We've not been directly involved. We have commented. We had a point of view.
Yes.
We've not been opinions. Engaged by Marks and Sparks dealing about it, I should be clear.
well, yes. But I mean, how much is that an example of what Create Streets or what yourself or what people want in terms of, it seems that the development as proposed by Marks and Spencers is quite unpopular. There have been plenty of other designs put forward, you know, not least by yourself and Francis Terry. I mean, how is Orchard House a sort of example of bad designs? Maybe not the right word, bad decision making.
I think you could say bad design. I mean, actually, I know the architect who's done it. He's a nice man. Okay, I mean, there's just so many levels. Just for members of those watching or listening who haven't seen it. So Orchard House is one of the two landmark Marks and Spencer department stores on Oxford Street. There's one at the, like, at the Oxford Circus end and one at the Marble Arch end. This is at Marble Arch end. It's three buildings, actually. It's a rather fine, late classical 1930 building, very sort of the late end of the classical tradition, and then two, frankly, very ugly 1960s and 70s buildings. What Marks and Spencer want to do is knock the whole thing down and start again, building a very large, rather faceless building that I think it's fair to say sort of doesn't fit the Oxford Street vernacular as it stands. It's perhaps a slightly scarred vernacular. And there have been several debates about it. One has been about the value that we put on non-modernist 20th century buildings in the listing system. So many people, including me, have been critical that Historic England didn't at the very least list the facade of the remaining 1930 building. I mean, to be fair to Marks and Sparks, the inside, with the exception of one Art Deco staircase, is pretty much gutted already. So I don't think it's easy to make a case, and I certainly wouldn't make one, for keeping the inside of the building. I think it's fair to hollow it out. I don't think anyone sensible on heritage grounds makes a case for keeping the two 1970s buildings. So there's been that debate. There's been a second debate about what is called embodied carbon. And that's the carbon that is inherent in a building because it's been built. And the case that many would make, including myself, is that we should create buildings that will last, I mean, literally for centuries. And that's one of the most important ways of creating buildings in a, you know, sustainable and green fashion. And if we have to knock a building down every 30 years, the amount of wastage inherent in that is just astronomical. That's, I think, it's probably fair to say, has been the debate that has raged most clearly in the public domain, and that's where Save Britain's Heritage has perhaps focused its campaigning. And then I think there's a third theme, which is actually just the sheer quality of the facade and its impact of Oxford Street, which I think most people have said would be detrimental. Actually, although Architecture Journal has just announced, literally in the last few days, a competition for alternative designs, to the best of my knowledge, there hasn't been an alternative design to the one, until the one that Great Streets and working with our old friend Francis Terry have recently worked up. It's not actually, at the time of doing this podcast, possibly not by the time it goes live, it isn't actually yet public, so I hope it'll be public by the time this conversation hits the Country Life newsstands, as it were. But we've worked up. We started a lot of our early projects were counter proposals. We now tend to work actually for the landowner instead, but a lot of our early schemes were counter proposals. Often worked up with Francis. So we've worked up with Francis a development which matches it, or very, very nearly matches it, in terms of gross development area. We would certainly suggest, as I'm afraid Westminster City Council opposes, that it should be for homes, flats, as well as for offices and shops. And we've designed a galleried arcade going to the back, actually matching the use that Marks & Sparks wanted. And we've created a large, confident, burlesque, classical building. We then polled it with the public and got essentially just under 80% public support. And I have to say, that matches every single poll we've ever done and every poll we're aware of internationally. In a fair fight, we've got a visual preference survey technique, which we now use up and down the country and indeed internationally, where you basically control for everything. You make sure if you're comparing two images, they're from the same angle, same distance, sky colour's the same. If there's a happy mother walking with her contented baby and pram in front of one, you've got the same woman walking in front of the other. So, you make everything else the same and you just compare you just change the thing you're comparing. So it might be the street enclosure, it might be the height, it might be the nature of the building, it might be presence or absence of street trees or whatever it might be. It's a fair survey done in a fair national poll, and it's an off-the-scale win for the more textured, in this case, classical design, which I say didn't surprise us, and we'll hopefully be hitting the newsstand soon. But so that's, bluntly, if Marks & Sparks had been more humble, and a little less greedy, and had said, look, let's keep some of the old, because what we did, we essentially kept the 1930 building, we doubled it up, added a few stories, and then bunged a gallery through the middle between the new and the old bit. I think if they'd done something similar to that many, many months ago, they would have long since have had planning permission. So it's not just about the embodied carbon, very important though that is. It's actually also about the courtesy and love with which the building meets the street.
And it will be a sort of a modern building with a heritage facade in theory, the one you propose.
Well,
which sort of fills in the gaps of...
We propose keeping a chunk of the facade, and then accepting, I think, that the more recent buildings should go, because I think they're of... I was going to say they're of no merit. I think one can go further than that. They're jolly ugly. They're rude to Oxford Street. They're lumpen. They're careless. They're loveless, and the best thing for them is to turn them into landfill or some. No, I mean, let's recycle them into sort of concrete for a runway or something. Which is interesting. What happened to Rowland Point? Sorry, I'm interrupting. So Rowland Point, which is a famous 1950s, I think, might have been early 60s tower block that collapsed and largely ended the program of publicly subsidised, council tower block building post-war. It ended up as the rubble from it ended up as the hardcore inside the City of London airport, which is a very good use for it.
Oh yeah, there you go. That's a fun fact that I definitely didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really recommend using it at dinner parties. I'm not sure it'll get you very far. But
No, I think that's coming straight onto my dinner party repertoire. you mentioned faceless just a few minutes ago. I noted in a sort of tweet you put up the other day, I won't mention the specific town, to save you from having people battering down your door,
but
you described it as placeless and faceless. Would you be able to elaborate on that a little bit?
I can't remember which town I was being rude about, or we were being rude.
It starts with a B and it's in the West Country.
Okay, which one was that? Oh, yes. It comes back, it's half repeating or rhyming with what I was saying before. Actually, most people, some do, but most people don't, sit here. I mean, I don't think about buildings that much. They don't actually say, buildings must look old. That's not what they say. Some do, but as I said, not most. what they want is places that are polite and humane, and that, and forgive me, I'm about to use a pompous word, which are biomorphic. That's a long word for saying that echo some of the shapes and forms and rhythms of nature. So, as best neuroscientists can judge, and it's clearly true that this happens. So, imagine going for a walk, in a lovely, in fact, it's easy to do right now, in a lovely spring forest with, the bud falling from the trees and the birds singing and the flowers and the tendrils coming out. That makes most of us happy. That is good for us. At an innate, fundamental level, we find that settling and enjoyable.
Yeah.
That is the common reaction from the vast, vast majority of people, unless you've got some deep psychological scar that sadly has affected you. Now, when we have streets and buildings which have that same coherent complexity that nature seems to have, well, nature does have, so it's got patterns that mimic nature, not
precisely painting leaves on the side of them.
But you've got embedded symmetries. Yeah, you've got things that have detail and texture. As you get up, imagine getting up close to a lovely old stone wall or a brick wall. You've got the light refracted from all the complexity in it. But as you step away from it, it resolves itself into a series of repeated, variable, but nevertheless coherent, often symmetrical or semi-symmetrical patterns. That variety within a pattern, it's a statement of fact that most of us prefer that. I think it's a statement of confident prediction, but perhaps not quite yet, fact that the reason most of us seem to prefer those types of buildings in the streets is they've got some of the same forms and features that we tend to find in nature. Most of us prefer that. So you come back to the use of the word faceless. And there is some polling on this. I think it's not completely robust yet. But buildings that to some degree have that type of symmetry that a face does, most of us can visually read it more quickly. So, we as humans can process faces very quickly. We read them very innately.
Yeah.
And buildings that have some of those patterns, maybe, I do stress the maybe there, we seem to prefer. And just on the placeless, again, it's a very, very consistent theme, particularly outside big cities. But even in big cities, you get it a bit differently. Most of us want changes to our neighbourhood, to our home, to our suburb, to our high street, to feel as if they are of here, from here, linked to here, in some way influenced by people we know, or at any rate, a local and trust. And as I say, you don't get that at a London or a Bristol level, but you will get it at a Greenwich or a Lewisham or a Catford or a, I'm sure Christian, as for other country life, there's lots of cases of copies of Catford. Yeah, you do get it at that level. You certainly get it at a street or an estate level. So on the whole, places that don't feel placeless, or developments, I should say, that don't feel placeless and that don't feel faceless, most of us, most of the time, will prefer and will feel can weave more naturally and comfortably into what's already there.
Very good. And how much is the sort of provision of local amenities an important part of sort of redeveloping our urban spaces? We'll talk about the sort of 15-minute cities and conspiracy theories in a bit, because I'm always find that very interesting. But just that concept of, I'm actually able to walk to a park, my streets are lined with trees, the GP is nearby, the supermarket is nearby, there's a pool and a playground I can walk to. How important is that, as well as decent building design and sort of creating places that people want to live?
It's a very good question. So at several levels, it's very important. And first of all, people will tell you it's important. So most people in a poll will say, yes, I want that. And if you don't believe what they tell you in a poll, a so-called stated preference, what economists will tell you is a better way of understanding what people want is what's called a revealed preference, pay for. So if you have a home on a street which is close to those things, whether it's a tube station or a train station or the local high street or the doctor's surgery or the nearby school. Schools are a huge, good schools are a huge driver of value. Those homes will be worth more controlling for other things. Now, if you're right on top of, if you like, the noisy bit of amenity, either busy high street or the noisy interchange, that will normally take out value. But once you're more than a few hundred yards away from it or a block away from it, so you've got the advantages of proximity without the disadvantages of, over proximity, that is, again, it's the same. But those are the types of home that in a small town or a bit of a big city, village is a bit more complex. It's harder to get robust data for villages because they're smaller. Mm-hmm. But, but certainly in an urban context, people will pay more for that. Then you get into really interesting issues of where it is and how you get there. The most efficient way to get is, and this is getting a little bit into 15-minute city territory, the most efficient way for streets to have lots of people using them, I'm not anti-car, cars have a very important role, it isn't by car. So if you're in a town, or actually within a village, if everyone is driving a short distance, you won't actually get many people using that road. A, because they just take up the space. B, because they need to be parked. And C, because they tend to knock out other uses. Let's open up. So finding ways of co-locating. I'll put it pompously, then I'll put it naturally. Doctor surgeries, shops, homes, churches, pubs, restaurants, all physically close together. So you know, one trip, you can do some version of all of them. That's just a more efficient way of creating design. And it is what we say, and indeed pay for more in. Now, that's not to say, perhaps I'm anticipating your next question, James, but cars are great. Cars give you and me and anyone else the liberty that in the 19th century had to be a duke to enjoy, to move around the country, very naturally and easily. I was reflecting on the history of footpaths the other day. The reason why our countryside is crisscrossed and interwoven with this marvellous web of footpaths that we all, those of us who go to the countryside, enjoy, is because, of course, if you didn't have cars, to get from any point A to point B, you really do want to go the shortest way possible. And in the way that we would now just drive around the country lanes, probably quite circuitously to get from A to B, 100 years ago, you just walked it essentially across the fields because it would literally half the length of time take that. That's not pertinent anymore. But so the reason we have that web of footpaths is because we didn't have cars. Now we do have cars, so cars are great. But once we get into a town or inside a village, the diseconomies, the noise, the pollution, killing children or threatening to kill children, just the sheer amount of space they take up, then I would say, and I think the evidence supports this, more of a downside than an upside. So we need to we sort of fell in love with the motor car in the 1930s conceptually, and then city planners for 30 or 40 years imagined that the cities of the future would literally be terra rasa. I mean, there were plans to do this in London, plans to do it in Paris or Futurama in New York. Yeah, Patrick Abercrombie, his plan for London, and I'm not exaggerating at all what I'm about to say, I can't remember the number now, but I mean, he planned to move 40% of the East End out of London, to clear vast swathes of the City of London, to have a series of five ring roads with a motorway box in the middle of London. And then as the plans evolved a bit and became more detailed, I mean, thankfully most of this never happened, but, the Strand was going to turn into dual carriageway, Covent Garden would go, Whitehall was going to go other than the Banqueting House and 10 Downing Street. Huge swathes of London would have gone. For a brief period, anything built in central London needed to have, an integral feature at first story level to plug into the walkways and bridges that were essentially going to be the way humans got around in London with all the traffic at ground floor level, a series of motorways going through central London. The urban destruction that would have involved, it's mad, would have made the Blitz feel like a mere rounding error in comparison. We've actually already turned the corner on this. Is we now realise that is insane. I mean, anyone listening to this, I assume, will be saying that's clearly mad. But it wasn't mad in the late 60s and 70s. That was literally what the GLC planned to do, the Conservative GLC, and they then rightly lost the election in 1970 or 1972. I can't remember because the public didn't want it. And we sort of now need. So we've turned the corner in places like London on this. So we now need to slightly turn the corner, I think, in lots of villages and smaller towns, where we need to realise, well, actually, if we just have a slightly more generous relationship between humans and the motor car, where humans come first and cars fit round them rather than the other way round, the evidence, we've just written a research project on this called Move Free, which I recommend to all your readers. Towns will be more prosperous. More people will be there. More people will live there. Shops will do better. And other things held equal, people will be happier. Sorry, a long answer again. Forgive me, James. Rant over now.
No, like I said, no, long answers are very good. I just find what you said very interesting because, it does feel that certain parts of London have been sort of designed, like you said, with the car first and the person second. And it just seems like a silly way of getting around sometimes. I'm very lucky in the bit of Southwark that I live in a sort of social housing estate. Everything I really need is actually you know, pretty much on my doorstep. And this is a built, you know, this is an estate from the 1950s and 60s. And it's, you know, it goes to show, I think, that the ideas you're espousing, which I think most of our listeners would agree with, they're not necessarily brand new ideas. They're just ideas that haven't really been executed particularly well in the past, I don't know, 50, 60 years of planning policy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's got better. I certainly agree with you. I don't really pretend that what I'm suggesting is radically new. In fact, it's deeply old. I mean, yeah, I think you can have a sort of, you know, a left wing and a right wing variant of it. But essentially, we're saying, look, if you speak to your neighbours and can walk more often, you're probably going to be happier and healthier, which again is empirically true.
Well, quite. Yeah.
And if you, as you walk around your daily, you know, activity, if the buildings in the street make you feel happy and safe and purposeful as you look around, that will make you happier too. So, you know, these are sort of one level of statement sort of the bleedingly obvious. But what I think perhaps what Create Streets and I hopefully have done a little bit new is perhaps I was using slightly emotive language then, but we tried to strip it down into language and numbers that pension funds and treasury officials and sceptical politicians can be convinced by and understand. And I think that's reasonable, because I mean, you know, if just putting corbels on buildings is just cost and no upside, well, let's not do it. The point is that actually it isn't just cost, it's also upside. So hopefully we're trying to find an empirical way of talking about it that can reach audiences that, you know, convoluted conversations about architectural theory just don't cut through to. But rightly so, because many of them are completely fact-free zones.
Gotcha. Well, it sounds like you're making a little bit of headway in the halls of government, because earlier this year, the Office for Place was created, set up, I think, which is a sort of arm's-length body of the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities. You are the chair of the Office for Place. Can you tell us a bit about what the Office for Place is and what it hopes to do?
So actually, it was created last year, but I think I'll forgive you that outrageous error.
Oh, dear, sorry.
I'm teasing. It's emerged. So some years ago, I was a member of, and then ended up co-chairing with the late Roger Scruton, a commission that the government created, crikey, 4 years ago now, the Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission. Quite a lot of the changes in planning policy that have come over the last few years are ultimately indirectly or directly a consequence of that. One of our proposals, which actually, if I'm honest, I was a little bit nervous about to start with, but I've grown more confident over time, was that there should be some sort of body, quite small, quite modest, if you like, who cared about these things and whose fulcrum was, how do we make sure that planning policy is supporting popular and beautiful new places and doesn't get distracted by all the other things that, you know, rightly, government needs to deal with. The then Secretary of State, Robert Jenrick, asked if I would chair the process of creating that, which I agreed to do. So that now legally exists. I'm the acting chair of it. I've got a board in place. We're recruiting officials based up in Stoke-on-Trent, in Staffordshire. And our role, now that there are much clearer asks in national planning policy on local authorities setting planning policy to ensure that their local policy is visual, is popular, and sets planning certainty in a way local people will understand, like very much what we were just talking about, our job is to help them do that. I mean, it's publicly happy to say it again. That is quite a big change for how some bits of the planning system work, because we've had a very discretionary case by case approach where the local plan, I suspect many of your listeners, if they're sensible, have not read many local plans. I certainly don't recommend it. It's deeply tedious. It takes a long time. They're very long, very verbal documents. Give them to a good planning lawyer and he or she can really do, I wouldn't quite say whatever they like with them, but you can really have fun and you can take it in many different directions. Yeah. It's not setting clarity for what's acceptable around it. Come back to that poll I cited from YouGov. As we hopefully move from local plans, which are long, verbose, verbal, unclear, to setting area-wide codes, which define good ordinary visually, empirically, numerically, and set a bit of planning certainty in a way that is locally acceptable to the local population. It's not for me to define what that is. Our job is to help local councils and officials and councillors make that change. And by the way, it will take a generation. This is not going to happen overnight. And it's a new way of doing things for local officials. So, you know, and some of them, again, I don't think it's unfair to say this, some of them are finding that quite challenging. Others are embracing it. And most people are somewhere in the middle. And certainly it's a new skill set. And, you know, it's actually forcing planners, and I think many of them welcome this, to think about what is popular and vernacular and local and what people want, actually with a focus they haven't had to do before. And again, I think the good ones of them are welcoming that. I think others are finding it quite challenging. and my dog has just come to say hello. So if I say "damn boy," I'm not talking to you, James. Oh,
that's,
Harry.
That's good. Nubby.
My right calf's now being licked. Harry, go away. Sorry, James. Back to you. Forgive me.
That's all right. That's quite all right. Sometimes my cat jumps on my head while I'm recording these podcasts as well, but we edit out the screams so no one can ever tell. I just think it's quite interesting that you say that, you know, it's local planning authorities hadn't really considered, you know, local vernacular and local materials and things like that until quite recently. It strikes me as a bit of an oversight.
Put as starkly as that, and I apologize if I said it quite loose, that's a little unfair. I wouldn't put it as starkly as that. Yeah. Lots of conservation areas and conservation area statements, which are very expert reports into what is the local vernacular. So people, they have considered it, particularly in conservation areas. What hasn't happened most of the time is that has then flown through to policy in a way that is actually enforceable. So, you know, there are genuinely some really expert local conservation area statements. But then if you actually look at the local plan, it says that, and I'm obviously going to massively generalise now, but, you know, that new buildings should contextually respond to that. Well, what does that mean? I can assure you there are architects and planning lawyers out there who can make that mean whatever you like.
As
I say, sometimes it is absolutely right that you insert a building that is shocking and totally different to what's there. There is absolutely a case that, particularly in cities, I think, you know, and things need to change. But we can't have all our buildings like that, because it's like living in a bar fight. Most of us want our homes to be a little bit more settling than that. So I think most developers won't want to do that. Some will. Yeah. Some architects will, and I encourage that. But what for the mass majority who won't, who just want to, you know, make a good buck for doing a good thing, let's make it really easy. Right. You know, and by the way, the Cotswolds, we're talking about conservation areas, the Cotswolds conservation areas are quite good at this, right? You know, you will build in this local stone. Yeah. Here are the window patterns. Here are some house types. Here's some pre-approved pattern books. Let's make it really easy to do something we know local people want. So it's that bit that hasn't happened. It's not that they haven't cared about it, about it, or actually studied it. It just hasn't actually flown through effectively to policy. One of the reasons for that, as I say, is that planning policy has had as its, perhaps it's one of the sort of keys of imprimaturs, that it shouldn't, that it should actually keep every option open. And I think what we're trying to do is to say, look, most of the time, make it easy to make it really constrained, but just keep that option there, you know, for the odd special case.
Very sensible. Very sensible indeed. We're sort of almost running out of time. So just a few more questions, if that's okay, Nicholas. I guess the first one I'll ask is, if you were Prime Minister for a day, what would you do?
That's fooled me. I've no idea. I promise, for a day you can't really do anything, can you? If I had a magic wand, is perhaps a better way of putting it. Look, if I had a would finish that change of the planning system. I would change the approach to the governance. In fact, this is something that we've talked about before. To street trees and greening up of streets in the public realm. At the moment, it's very, very hard for parishes or local communities to green up their streets. I would depower highways authorities on that. I would flip the way that we model future traffic requirements, so that instead of just assuming traffic use goes up forever, we don't. I would change. It's quite a lot I do in my day. I'd be very busy. I would change our approach to the regulation of things such as new trams. At the moment, basically, we can't put trams in because we have to dig up all the utilities underneath the tracks. That essentially means that they're just too expensive to put in.
Gotcha.
The rest of Europe seems to cope without doing that, so I'd flip to that. And I would magic up a couple of, this is the magic wand bit, I would, and it's certainly not a prime minister's role to do this, I should say, I would also have at least one in Europe, ideally one per country, architecture and design school that is teaching vernacular design as well as modernism. I probably a bit more than that, so that there are just enough young architects and planners coming through who properly understand architecture before about 1930. I mean, at the moment we're basically doing pastiche modernism, and, you know, we should do pastiche everything, and then allow all of the traditions to continue evolving in the way that they should. There you go. That would keep me quite busy, I think.
Yeah, I think it would. Just to briefly touch on your you discussed greening up there. I remember reading your report, it must have been last year, and I was absolutely shocked at how difficult it is to basically plant a tree on a street. It was completely mind-boggling how, you know, if I wanted to, me and sort of members of my local community wanted to stick up some trees and even water them on the road outside my house, so how difficult that would be. Is it a sort of case, do you think, you know, without going too far down the lines of isn't bureaucracy terrible, but in certain cases, aren't you sort of sitting there scratching your head going, why have we made this so difficult for ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, I try not to sort of get into sort of, you know, evil bureaucrats type territory, because, you know, all the civil servants and bureaucrats I've met are good people trying their best. So I wouldn't put it, I know you're sort of setting up a straw man there for me, but I wouldn't put it like that. What I would say is, over the course of 50 or 60 years, when it comes to the governance and the management and the design of our streets, we have made a category error that has been getting worse, I think is now getting better, which is to assume that the primary role of a street, as well as a road in the countryside, is to allow cars to drive through it as fast as possible. And when it comes to certainly an urban street, or indeed a street in a village, that is just incorrect. The primary role of a street is to allow as many people as possible to get through it in a way that is good for the place they're getting through. And there's obviously a bit of tension between those two. We haven't really talked about street trees, but in all the metadata, as well as some of the more detailed data, street trees are basically as close to it will always be a good thing to do as you can get. Now, so you can plant them everywhere because there will be some, you know, tensions with existing utilities or existing other uses. But we've made it very hard. And what we propose in the report, which is something that's already done in places like Holland, is, look, define more precisely the nature of the street or the public square, and predefine the types of places where it is possible to green up, as we called it. That might be planting street trees, it might be something else, in a way that isn't, you know, impeding other people or creating constraints, and then allow, if they wish, parishes, neighbour groups, individuals, groups of neighbours to plant street trees and to green up their places. And for example, the Dutch have lots of quite small alleys in some of their historic cities, often but not always called woolnerfs, which are not vehicular, quite narrow, they're lovely places. Essentially, the residents on those woolnerfs normally have the right, sometimes just pot plants, sometimes there's a bit more, to green up their woolnerfs. And, you know, I defy anyone to see one of these and not want to spend time there. They're just lovely and they're good. I mean, they're just good for us. Hmm. So we have to sort of work out how we can just start turning some of that back on again. And I think this is a different, you know, past doesn't have to be, sorry, the future shouldn't be the same as the past. Actually, I think we can manage our historic towns, new places we create, actually to be better than the past, by having more street trees and more greenery in them than we probably did 100 or 200 years ago. So we can actually make things better. But I should say, quite a lot of street trees that were planted, particularly after things such as World War I, there were lots of memorial avenues planted, memorial trees after the horrors of the Great War. You know, most of those, many of them have been chopped down and have not been replanted. So, you know, to some degree, we're just catching up with where we were.
Yeah.
There are no easy wins in anything in life, but switching on that ability, and it would take a little bit of legislative change, a bit of regulatory change, would be as close to an easy win as we get. I'm actually very confident that will happen because I just don't think there's a political mindset against it. It's just a little bit of inertia and lethargy and having to change the way we do things, which, you know, will always take a little while.
Yeah, banning trees, you feel like, is not going to be too much of a vote winner for any party.
No, but more street trees is typically popular. But, you know, people rightly will be concerned about where and what and other consequences.
Totally acceptable. Okay, one last question, I suppose, and it's just a simple one, which is what are some of your favourite buildings, or indeed, what is your favourite building?
That's a very good question. Weirdly, I think more about streets and places than buildings. So if you'll forgive me, I'll slightly morph the question. It's a bit of a cheat, this. I'm old enough, you may not be, but back in the 1970s and 80s, there was a famous advertisement that Ridley Scott, you know, latterly of Titanic and etc. fame, did, that was a faux Yorkshire hill. Had a boy with a Yorkshire accent pushing his Hovis bread bicycle up what was actually Gold Hill in Shaftesbury in Dorset. That is a gorgeous street. It's a run of very simple vernacular cottages curving down the street. So it's sinuously, you know, you've all seen anyone who reads Country Life has seen pictures or indeed visited the street.
Yes.
I mean, you clearly can't have every street like that, but it's very simple vernacular cottages, that variety in a pattern. It curves down the hill. You've got the lovely rolling countryside of Cranbourne Chase laid out in front of you or behind the hills. So, I mean, I find it very hard. I mean, we have a little cottage near there. I find it very hard not to stand at the top of that hill and sort of sigh in a contented way. In terms of towns, neighbourhoods, I've actually always, I'm not sure why, maybe because I lived there briefly, I've always had a soft spot for Pimlico, which is probably as close as any English town or neighbourhood gets to Paris or to European urbanism. It's quite tight. It's quite stucco. It's obviously Thomas Cubitt who created it for the Mayfair estate. I don't mean that. I mean for the Grosvenor estate. I love the tightness of that. And perhaps I slightly like the Continentals. I think of world cities. And this is a bit cliched. So again, I'm giving you buildings and places. As I'm giving places and streets, not buildings. My first ever holiday with my then girlfriend, long since now wife, was to Vienna. Which is all that sort of wealth and the power of the Habsburgs poured into one city and then expanded to confidently in the mid-19th century. The two-story shops they have on some of these high Viennese streets, I think it's just glorious. I think it was Bill Bryson who wrote that if the Martians invaded Earth, they would assume that Vienna was the world capital. So it's a bit grandiloquent. It's a bit pompous at times. It's quite fun. But I think actually when they were quite young, we took my children to Venice. And I remember my youngest son, as we went down the Vaporetto, down the Canal Grande, you know, he was probably 5 or 6 or 7 then, I think probably 6 or 7, looking up at all the palazzos as we went past, just in awestruck wonder at the infinite beauty and passion of these buildings. So I think a combination of his own inherent beauty, its walkability, its safety, although it's, you know, got its own challenges, and that memory of my... both children, particularly one son, just staring up at it. So there you go. I think I've probably given you more of the answer than you wanted, but that would be my places.
It's a very fine answer indeed. Very, very fine answer indeed. I think, sadly, that's all we've got time for today, Nicholas, but we'll definitely have to have you back on because I know there's plenty more to talk about and I'm certainly very interested to hear more of what you've got to say.
Thank you.
But in the meantime, thank you very much, Nicholas, for joining us. You can follow him on X, formerly known as Twitter. You can buy his book, which is called
Yes, Free Parking. Yes, buy my book. Exactly, buy my book. No Free Parking.
It's called No Free...
Yes, exactly. Sorry.
Yeah, James. That's now... that's quite all right. Yeah, No Free Parking, The Curious History of London's Monopoly Streets. So many thanks to you, Nicholas. Many thanks to Toby Keel, my esteemed editor and producer. And many thanks to, of course, you, the listener. See you next week.
Thank you.